Good evening and welcome to lesson 5 of our course, the Jewish course of Why. We're going to start on page 200 with our first question.
My first question is, why don't we do a
bracha? A bracha? Do a bracha. What kind of bracha do you want to do? Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Asher Kidishanu B'mitzvos V'tzivonu Al Divrei Torah. Why are the Jewish holidays always late or early? You always hear that type of conversation amongst the Jewish community. Why is Pesach so late this year? Why was Rosh Hashanah so early this year? That's a common term you hear. Now the simple answer, I can give you a short answer, that we follow an alternative calendar.
The simple answer is you ask the rabbi.
That's right. Well, and here goes the answer. Most of civilization use one of two calendars. Solar-based calendar based on the Gregorian calendar or a lunar-based calendar. Now, the solar year is 365 days long. The lunar month is a little less than 30 days. 12 lunar months constitute a year, but that takes only 354 days for the moon to complete 12 orbits around the Earth. And so 11 days less than the Gregorian calendar. So the lunar calendar ends up being 11 days earlier than the solar calendar. So you have people like the Muslims, who, I don't know if you know this, but you'll learn something about Islam at a Jewish class, course of Why. They follow a lunar calendar as well. And their holidays are based on the lunar calendar. But they don't reconcile the two calendars, which is why Ramadan, which is based on the lunar calendar, every year gets 11 days earlier. And so for centuries now, it keeps on going 11 days earlier, so Ramadan could be in the summer sometimes, it could be in the winter sometimes, it could be in the spring and the fall. And it's been all of those, because every year you're going back 11 days because the cycle doesn't match. Now, each calendar is really independent of each other, so if you're following a solar calendar, it's not like New Year's comes out later or earlier, it comes out when it comes out on the solar calendar, and it may feel different if you're trying to reconcile two calendars. Why in Judaism does it need to change? Because in Judaism we believe there needs to be an integrated system. And this is a big mistake. Well, it's not a big mistake. There's a misconception a lot of Jews make, saying, oh, I don't follow the solar calendar, I'm a Jew, I follow the lunar calendar, and that's all. That's not true. Judaism very much takes into consideration the solar calendar as well. Which is why if you take the Chabad calendar, you'll have the Jewish lunar dates, but you'll also have the secular dates of what we call the Gregorian or the solar calendar. Why would you need to integrate both? Let's look at text. Do you have a question? Go ahead.
Yeah, so has that always been the case?
The integration? Absolutely.
So what were they integrating with back in the time of Moses?
With which calendar? With the solar calendar.
Well, the Gregorian calendar didn't exist at that time.
Right, but so they worked with the actual sun, you know, based on the seasons when the sun, you know, when the days get longer, the days get shorter. That always happened, whether there was an actual calendar for it or not. Days got, you know, summer got longer days, winter got shorter days, that always existed, and it was way more complex, is my guess, but they were probably way smarter as well, so it wasn't too complicated.
Well, the Gregorian calendar doesn't match up either, but that's another story.
I'm not a calendar expert, I'm not. Not even in the lunar calendar, I'm not an expert. If you study the Rambam's laws of Kiddush HaChodesh, how to sanctify the moon, and he talks about all the astronomy, it's very perplexing to me and any others who are not very good at this. I'm sure Penn loves it, but for regular people like me, it's not the funnest time of the year. It goes over your head too. Make me feel good, Penn. At least make me feel good. So we're going to look at text number one from the safe, talk about Maimonides. Stana, we'll start with you. Go ahead.
The months of the year are lunar months, as it says in Numbers 28:14. The burnt offering of the month when it is renewed. Monthly renewal is relevant to the lunar cycle. It also says in Exodus 2:12:2, this month shall be for the first of months, about which our sages commented that God showed Moses in a vision of prophecy an image of the moon and told him, when you see the moon like this, declare it a new month. Talmud or the Shabbat.
And so, for starters, the Jewish calendar is lunar-based. It has lunar months. That's how the Jewish calendar follows. One reason God chose the system for the Jewish calendar to be lunar-based is related to the fact that the Jewish people have very much in common with the moon. We do special sanctification of the moon. What's our connection with the moon? You know, they say the story about a teacher who asked the students in elementary school, which is more useful, the sun or the moon? And after a moment of silence, a 10-year-old raised his hand and said, I think it's because the moon I think the moon is more important because the moon shines at night when you want the light, whereas the sun shines during the day when you don't need it. And, you know, the question really is, why are Jews so interconnected with the concept and with the reality of the moon? Let's look at text number two. There's no reason to keep your curiosity going. Go ahead, Michal.
The moon begins to shine on the first of Nisan. As the month proceeds, the moon's light increases until its disk becomes full on the 15th. From the 15th, its light diminishes. On the 30th, its light cannot be seen. The Jews shall
share
a similar faith. Thank you.
And so, the Jews are like the moon. The sun shines every day. The Jews have better times and we have worse times. We have times that we start fading away and then we reappear. We have times that we're really shining in all its glory. We have times that we're slightly diminished, a little bit more diminished. We are a reflection, really, of the moon. The same, the Jewish people and the moon have a similar state of being in the fact that we come and go depending on the season and depending on the time of the month. And so, the rest of the world, you know, pretty much has stability compared to the Jews, but the Jews don't have the stability. We're very similar to the moon. And so, symbolically, we're connected to the moon. So that explains why we're connected to the lunar calendar, but why the integration? Why do we care? Why don't we just do what the Muslims do? Why do we care if Sukkot ends up being in the middle of Pesach? Or, I mean, in the spring, or Pesach being in the middle of the winter? Who cares?
Well, for one thing, our calendar is tied into the heart.
Oh, very good. Let's take a look at text number three. Go ahead, Quincy.
Keep the month of spring and make the Passover offering to God. For in the month of spring, God brought you out of Egypt at night.
And so, first of all, the Exodus took place in the spring. So whether we, you know, whether we want to connect the solar and lunar calendars or not, the reality is if you want to celebrate Pesach, Passover, at the season of the year in which it originally took place, then it has to be in the spring because that's when it took place. Furthermore, as Quincy mentioned, all the Jewish holidays are connected. There's a historical, in addition to the historical dimension, it takes place in the springtime because it celebrates the beginning of the springtime barley harvest. And so it's connected to the harvesting of barley. And so if Pesach ends up being in Hanukkah time during the winter, A, it's not at the same time of the Exodus, and B, it's not the time of the harvest. So while Ramadan is all about, you know, activities that they do to whatever it is they're commemorating, they really don't care what time of the year it is. For us, seasons do matter. So while we do recognize the importance of the lunar calendar and its connectedness with the Jewish people, we can't take away the fact that the solar calendar, which is the way the seasons operate, is very much connected to the Jew as well. In 1984, it was a Jewish leap year, which is exactly what we do when we want to make sure we don't end up messing with the seasons. This year, 5776 on the Jewish calendar, is a Jewish leap year. Today, actually, funny enough, or by divine providence, today is the first of 2 days of Rosh Chodesh, where we usher in the second month of Adar. So when we make a Jewish leap year, we have 2 months of Adar, so that Passover should end up being in what we call the spring season. And so this way, every couple of years, you add a month, and this way the 11 days that you keep on missing doesn't end up messing the season, which is why we add it right before Passover, right before we go into the new cycle of holidays starting from Passover. There's the ultimate integration of solar and lunar. Because it's this month that we're now going to help, but this bonus month, we're now going to allow for the lunar calendar and the solar calendar to be integrated properly, that the seasons and the lunar months are on the same page.
What's the frequency of the leap year? Is it every 3 to 4 years?
Yeah. And so we have it. I mean, the last one was, it was a couple of years ago, not too long ago. And we don't add days to the months. We add a full month of Adar, which is why Purim this year is in the second Adar, not in the first Adar, because it's always 30 days before Passover. And so, by adding that extra month, we solve the problem that the Muslims are not looking to solve, but we, wanting that integration, would like to solve. So 1984 was a similar year like this year, was a leap year. The Rebbe addressed the issue of why it's so important in Judaism to have that fusion of solar and lunar. And if you think about it, everything in Judaism is meant to teach us something. So if we're celebrating a leap year, the question is, what does it teach us? What does the integration of lunar and solar calendars teach us in our day-to-day service of the Almighty, in our day-to-day service of God? And so if you think about it, the sun is a steady luminary. The sun is steady. It shines every day just as it did the day before. The moon is highly adaptable. It changes over time. Throughout the month it's constantly changing. One day it shines brighter, the next day it's weaker. And that can teach us a lesson in life. So just for learning exercise, Mick, if you could turn around and pass the bucket of pens. Learning exercise number one, describe in what way the lunar message of change and the solar message of constancy would be beneficial in the following areas of life. Relationships, education, Judaism, and career. Anyone want to share? Don't be bashful.
Take it away, Ben. Okay, so with relationships, with the benefits of the sun, you want to be reliable, you want to be loyal, you want to be trustworthy. Yeah, you want to be consistent like the sun. But with the moon, you can't be so rigid that you can't adapt when something comes up.
Very good. So the key is that when it comes to the solar integration into our life, it's the importance of having steadfast principles. That there are certain things in our life that are principled, that in this sphere flexibility and changes are disadvantages. There's a disadvantage to them. It doesn't help you whatsoever. It just shows on lack of stability and consistency, and shows that you lack character. Perhaps it's the opposite of what a politician is. So having a steadfast principles is vital when it comes to education, to religion. But then there's the moon, and the moon changes, which means it's the reminder that we grow. And we need to be dynamic, we need to be open to new ideas and flexible in their perspectives. Within the context of principle, there's a lot of maneuvering, there's a lot of growth. And you need to be open to that. And when you're raising a child, when you're dealing with education, that's really the message that children have to get, which is that you need to reconcile these two natures, the nature of being principled, but at the same time being open to learning more and to growing, and not to be stuck in a stagnant state. And that's a stagnation, and principle is not the same thing. People say, I have my principles and that's it, I'm not changing. No, you have principles. Doesn't mean you should sit there and do nothing to grow and to be better and to realize that there's room for growth and change. The moon reminds us there's room for growth and change. But always go back to the fact that you have the solar part, which is the principle foundation, and together with the fusion of the leap year, when you have the calendar, the solar and the lunar come together, it reminds you the importance of principle and the importance of growth. And this is what the Rebbe addressed in 1984 when they dealt with a similar year, with a leap year like we have now. And so for a Jew, yes, we follow a lunar calendar, but we also insist that it be integrated with the solar calendar, and that's the perfect fusion, the way we have to relate to our life and the collective life around us. Any questions? Go ahead, Quincy.
Yes, it's great what you said, but it's completely different than what I thought. What I was thinking was in terms of relationships,
neither. And
it's, well, that's the lunar cycle. The woman's cycle is cycle of the month.
And where does it integrate with the solar?
Well, I mean, in terms of our relationship with the moon, it's the same as our relationship with our wives.
I mean, sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not so good.
True.
Sometimes it's loony.
Literally, it's loony. Very good, very good. Quincy, one of these days, Mike Chait wrote a commentary on the Torah, one of these days you're going to write your own. Why do we say Mazel Tov? Where does that come from? I guarantee you, if you made a survey, 99.9% of Jews will not know the answer to what the hell it means and where it comes from.
I saw a clerk at Bowen House Hardware today that had Mazel Tov on a stamp on her hand.
And?
And I did not think this woman was Jewish. And I said, I was checking out, and I know the clerks really well there, you know. And,
I do too.
I said, so what's with the Mazel Tov? And she said, oh, that's just the stamp they were putting on our hands last night. I guess it was in some bar or something. And I went, oh. I said, and you know what it means, right? And she said, yeah. She said, it's Jewish for celebration.
Close enough. That's better than you'd expect.
Yeah, and I didn't know anything more about it, but I was just like...
You know, they say a guy, Michael Cohen, sadly entered the synagogue. He barely barged into the secretary's office and he sighed, I have to make arrangements for my wife's funeral and my wife's burial. Don't you remember, said the secretary to him, we buried your wife, your darling, 2 years ago. Thinking that he was forgetful, he nodded and said, I remember, that was my first wife, I'm here about the second. To which the secretary responded, Mazel Tov, I didn't know you remarried. And, you know, people use the term Mazel Tov in sometimes in the right context, sometimes in the wrong context. Perhaps if we knew what it actually meant, we'd think twice about it. For example, a lot of people in America, when they hear someone's pregnant, they say Mazel Tov. It's not the right term. The right term would be, you should say, Nagut Tashah, that when you give birth, it should be in a good, auspicious time. Mazel Tov is not related to something that didn't happen yet, as we're about to see. It has to be about something that's actually taking place, or, you know, transpiring as we speak. But let's see what it means. Now, in the Talmud, I should backtrack, before the Talmud, the first time the word Mazal in Hebrew is used in the Bible, it's in the book of Kings. There was a king named Josiah, Yoshio HaMelech. He was the king of Yehuda, of the Judean kingdom. He instituted major reform to rectify his grandfather Manasseh. His grandfather Manasseh was a wicked, evil, idolatrous king. Josiah repented. As a young child, he realized that there was something called the Torah, which he was never taught about, and he brought Torah Judaism back to the Jewish people. As part of the process, he removed all pagan altars from the land of Israel and utensils from the temple that were used inappropriately. He abolished all forms of idol worship of the sun, the moon, and the Bible tells us, the Torah tells us, and the mazalot. What's the translation? The stars, the constellations. That's what mazal means. Mazal is an astrological term for the mazalot, for the constellations and the stars in the heavenly bodies above. Now,
wait a minute. You say he removed the mazalot?
He removed the idolatrous service. The Jews were serving. He eradicated the land of Israel from the idolatrous service. That there were people that used to pray to the constellations and the stars, and he removed that worship from amongst the Jewish people.
So it was like astrology.
Yeah, very much so. A form of astrology, except used in a very idolatrous way.
So how did we get luck from that?
Hold on. And so he removed it. A mazel comes from the Hebrew word nozel, which still today is a word in Hebrew. Nozel means to flow. Like when your nose is running in Hebrew, they say nozelecha. Your nose is running, it's flowing. That's the word mazal, comes from the word flowing. It represents the planetary bodies flow along their courses in the sky, and they gift the world with very, you know, if there's Mercury, if there's the sun, depending on the constellation that's in full. Judaism believes that these things have an effect on the world, the way we live. And we'll talk about that from the Talmud in a moment. The first reference to mazalot, to the constellations in the Bibles with regard to Yeshio. In the Talmud in medieval times, Jewish sages taught that the position of the planets at any given time affected and impacted events in the world. What we know today as astrology, but they do affect things in the world. And if you take a look at the following passage from the Talmud, it will speak as clear as it gets. And if anyone says, well, what does Judaism say about astrology? Talmud, Shabbat, go ahead, pen, page 204, text number 4.
He who is born under the constellation of the sun will be a distinguished man. He will eat and drink of his own, and his secrets will lie uncovered. If a thief, he will have no success. He who is born under Venus will be wealthy and unchaste. He who is born under Mercury will be of a retentive memory and wise. He who is born under the moon will be a man to suffer evil. He will build and demolish, demolish and build. He will eat and drink that which is not his, and his secrets will remain hidden. If a thief, he will be successful. He who is born under Saturn will be a man whose plans will be frustrated. Others say that all nefarious designs against him will be frustrated. He who is born under Jupiter will be a right-doing man. He who is born under Mars will be a shedder of blood. Rav Ashi observed, he will be a surgeon, a thief, a slaughterer, a circumciser.
One of the four. So he can end up being a murderer, or a moil and a sheikhev. Go ahead.
Abraham said before God, I have looked at my congregation and found that I am not fated to beget a child. God replied, cease your plan of gazing. What is your calculation? That Jupiter, the constellation you were born under, stands in the west? I will turn it back and place it in the east.
So it's very clear that from the Talmud embraces astrology. But it's very clear from the last statement about Avram that number one, you need to be a character like Abraham who can see into the constellations. Not every yodel with a crystal ball knows what in the world they're talking about, but if you have the powers, you're capable of it. And Avram clearly had the powers, but what he didn't realize, and God had to educate him, is that even if the mazel, even if your constellation is flowing energy to you that should result in a certain way, God can override that. It's not a get God at the end of the day is in charge, and even though naturally you should have it a certain way, God can override that. Go ahead.
Can you say that again?
That even though you naturally can have, you should be, the results in your life should be a certain way based on the constellations that are associated with how you were born or when this thing happened, God can override that. It's not a guarantee. The stars are not in charge. It's just an inclination of how things may result. And more importantly is that you have free choice. At the end of the day, you can change your mazel. Mazel is just a tendency, right? What did he say about the sheikhen and the mild, the slaughterer and the circumciser? You have a tendency to be bloody. You can allow that tendency to create a reality in you, you'll be a murderer. Or you can utilize that tendency and channel it to become a kosher slaughterer or a circumciser of children. I have a brother-in-law who's a mild and a sheikhen, he's a slaughterer and a circumciser. And I always tell him from this Talmudic statement, for years we've been telling him, that naturally you're a murderer. Thank God you shech the cow and you circumcise little kids, because now you'd probably be slaughtering people in the street, because that's your tendency to be a bloody person. And we believe that there is a connection between the constellation with the astrology that goes on at the moment that you're born, and the moment that you have, and every day actually, with what's going on in your life is connected to the various constellations that exist. That's what the Talmud says. Now remember, Talmud is not Jewish law. Talmud has a lot of things in it. Some of it is used as metaphorical stuff. Some of it is used as practical stuff. And you need to look at the commentators to see what they say. So just to make those that have issues with astrology feel good, even though I really shouldn't mention it, the Jewish sages of Marseille in France asked Maimonides, 12th century, about astrology. His answer was unequivocal. Look at text number 5, Stana, go ahead.
All predictions of the star gazers are lies in the opinion of all who are knowledgeable in science.
Rambam calls astrology lies. They are lies. Rambam believed that when the Torah, when the Talmud talks about astrology, it's talking metaphorical. It doesn't mean that if you were born on Monday and you're connected to this. That was Rambam's opinion. Now, anyone that knows anything about Rambam knows that he wasn't a wishy-washy. If he had opinions, he made him clear. But most of the Torah scholars in Rambam's era, they were called the Rishonim in the era of 11th, 12th, 13th century, disagreed with him. What did they say? Look at text number 6. Go ahead, Mick.
When a woman is in labor and others are outside the womb in the same house, they ought to pray for mercy upon her, and that the child should be born under a good mazel.
Look at the Hebrew for that, mazal tov. This is the first, or one, at least one of the first mentions we see of the word mazal tov in that context. That we pray for the woman, that the child that's going to be born shall be born in a good mazel, that the mazel coming down, right, she's about to give birth, there's going to be a divine, via the constellation, there's going to be a flow of energy, that the flow of energy going down to this newborn should be with a good flow. If you, the literal translation is, a good flow.
Boy, this is confusing.
Why?
Well, why outside the room, for one thing?
You're not going to be in a room when a woman gives birth.
Well, if you're a woman that's assisting her, you sure could.
Right.
So why would you have to be? It says, and others are outside the room, they ought to pray. What about, why would this be limited only to people that aren't in the room?
That's the only question about why the doctors in the room are not praying. Seems like something bigger is bothering me.
Question,
I knew that.
The constellations you're referring to, which constellations?
The ones that the Talmud mentions.
Okay. And those are, can you name them?
He just mentions Mercury, Venus, the planets.
Well, that's interesting because it mentions some that are Sumerian and Greek and some that I guess are also Hebrew. I mean, what about Capricorn? What about Gemini? What
you want to know why they're not mentioned?
Yeah.
Well, for starters...
Are these the same constellations that are commonly acknowledged?
Correct.
So what is the origin of them? I've wanted to know this for years.
What the origin is?
Yeah, where did the terminology...
My belief...
Who looked up and saw Orion and said, oh, yeah, that's the hunter? And, you know, who looked up and...
It's a good question, but what I will say is that even if it was revealed by... what you would call secular scientists of the time, you know, whether it was Greek philosophy, I don't know where the scientists were. Torah was never opposed to taking that information and utilizing it as just because the Talmud's quoting it doesn't mean the Talmudic sages are the ones that discovered it. By all means, I mean, I believe that the Zohar and even Sefer Yetzirah, perhaps the Book of Formation, which is officially goes back to Adam, mentions some of the constellations. But in Judaism, despite what Rambam says, Judaism has never run away from the concept of astrology. It's always been part of its culture. Who taught it to the Jews? That's a question I don't know the answer to. But I do know that when you open up the books. From Kabbalah to Talmud to Jewish law to you name it, they're always referred to them. And even if there were constellations or planets that were discovered later, which there were after the Talmud era, we don't run away from it. We don't say, well, it's in... When Armstrong landed on the moon, I don't know if you know this, there were many Jews, Orthodox Jews, that were screaming, it's baloney, it's a lie, it's a myth. They were like... I understand. But when they landed on the moon, they were like conspiracy theorists. Who said it's impossible? Satmar, for example, is one of them. What was their source? Their source was, because it says in the prayer, when we do the sanctification of the moon, one of the prayers says, just as I'm standing and dancing here before you, and I can't touch you, may all the enemies of the Jewish people not, just like we can't touch the moon, may all the enemies of the Jewish people not be able to touch the Jewish people. And from there they said, well, it says we can't touch the moon, which means no one can land on the moon. And the Rebbe of Abrayan, in the late 60s, lambasted it and said, are you kidding me? It's one of the greatest miracles of our times that we're discovering new fascination of God's creation and that they literally don't know how to interpret the translation of the verse. I mean, the prayer is saying, it's just like I can't stand here right now and touch the moon, may the enemies of the Jewish people not be able to touch us. So when we discover new scientific research, whether it's associated with the constellations, the planets, or whatever, or anything else for that matter, as a Jew, our first inclination is not to run away from it, but is to embrace it and see how it fits with our structure of belief.
From a Rambam perspective, though, one could argue that there are also scientific problems to the route they said that they took to the moon.
If someone wants to argue about science, I'm certainly not the guy to argue with. If two guys want to fight over if Armstrong landed on the moon, I have no reason to get involved in the argument because I've never been there and I can't say one way or the other. If someone wants to argue me about the sushi in New York, I'll argue if it tastes good or not. But about the moon, is it really out of my realm? Planet sushi in New York is fantastic. But what I am saying is that we don't run with the one Mazel Tov. Every time someone says Mazel Tov, including if you're a Satmar sitting in Williamsburg, if you say Mazel Tov, it means by definition you are recognizing that there is a flow that comes from the mazalot, from the constellations, and you are asking that the flow of energy coming to this particular moment should be a positive one. So if you really don't believe in astrology, you should never utter the word mazal tov out of your mouth ever again. Which the Rambam probably didn't. But everyone else who may scream they don't believe in science is busy screaming mazal tov every 13 seconds. So you gotta choose which way you wanna go.
Can I also add?
Sure, you can add anything.
Mazal would usually mean like constellation, right? That would be like a real simple translation.
The literal translation is is flow. The flow. From the word nozel.
So, I mean, if you're going to just say simple, regular, in Hebrew, mazal would be like a constellation too. Right?
Today, yes. Today in modern Hebrew, mazal would be a constellation. But if you want to get to the root word of it, it means flow.
But in over here, in the passage from the Talmud, they're not mentioning constellations. This is just showing something about Judaism's traditional openness to astrology, so they're mentioning some planets.
So do you know anything about this?
A little bit.
So are the constellations linked to the months?
Yes.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, each month.
Each Hebrew month, it's not really Hebrew, but each Aramaic month is connected to a certain constellation.
So what's the leap month for Adar 2?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer. But I don't know if you a couple years ago. No, it's a good question.
I can't relax until I ask you a question.
A couple years ago, we had here four guys from New York that came out for a week of fishing. I don't know if you remember, Mick, you gave them directions to go.
Yep.
Four Orthodox guys who loved going crazy fishing. They were hiking a whole week. One of them, his name is Mendel Zirkin, he's from Yerushalayim. And after he left here, I don't know what happened to him in Montana, but he decided to become a Jewish expert on Jewish astrology. And today he goes around lecturing on Jewish astrology, and he became this expert who knows everything that Judaism says about astrology.
What's his name?
His last name is Zirkin, Zirkind.
Taking fishing. Sounds like an opportunity.
Not yet. My guess is that will happen. But anyhow, maybe one of these days, he loves going around to speak. Maybe one of these days, if I find out that he's compelling enough in his talks, I mean, just because he has the knowledge doesn't mean he's going to, you know...
We get all kinds of people trolling that through, doesn't
he? Yeah, tell me about it. So, on to our next question. Why do Jews eat gefilte fish on Shabbos? You know the story about a blind man was standing over a flower patch in Central Park, dangling a fishing rod over the flower patch. A concerned tourist walked over and asked, "What are you doing?" So the blind man said, "I'm fishing for lunch." So the person felt so bad for the blind man, the tourist invited him to a fancy restaurant for lunch. Making conversation with him over lunch, the tourist asked, "So how many fish did you catch today?" To which the blind man answered, "Including you, I've caught 6. And, you know, when you talk about fish on Shabbos, it's almost synonymous. Everyone knows you. What do you come? You come to eat a Shabbos dinner or Shabbos lunch. There's fish. There's a general mitzvah on Shabbos called Oinek Shabbos, having pleasure on Shabbos. And for some reason, traditionally, the pleasure of Shabbos, one of the foods that's considered pleasurable, is fish. Take a look at text number 7. I think we're with you, Quincy, right? Where are we? Go ahead, Quincy. I don't know who we're up to.
Why did Jews eat the gefilte fish on Shabbos?
No. Text 7.
Right. Fish pleasure. How should one have pleasure on Shabbat? Rav Yehuda, son of Rav Shmuel Bar Shabbat, said in Rav's name, with a dish of beets, large fish, and heads of garlic. Rav Chia Bar Ashi said in Rav's name, even something small, if it is prepared in honor of Shabbat, it satisfies the obligation to take delight. What is something small? Rav Papa said, a pie of fish hash.
So either way, whether you take the first opinion, the second opinion, big fish, small fish, fish is a big part of it. Why fish on Shabbos? What is unique about fish that you should have it on Shabbos? Most people don't realize that there's almost everything in Judaism. I say almost because some of the things we don't really understand. But almost everything in Judaism has sometimes a simplistic reason that we literally just don't know because we've never taken the time to research. So what is it with fish? With all due respect to vegans, why fish? Text number 8, pen, go ahead. Reb Tzadok, the famous master from Europe in the 18th century.
The primary way to take pleasure on Shabbat is by consuming fish. Unlike animals, there are no prohibited fats in fish, nor is there the prohibited sciatic nerve. Although poultry does not have these prohibited elements, the prohibition of blood still pertains to poultry, and it must be slaughtered in a proper manner. None of these laws pertain to fish. With regard to fish, there is no mixture of the holy and unholy.
Shabbos is a day that's supposed to be fully holy. During the week, during a weekday, we have integration. We're dealing with mundane. We have to figure out ways. We stay away from this. We don't do this. We're working. We're going to work. We're going to school. We're dealing with the outside world. And it's a world that consists of good and bad. And we're constantly choosing good over bad. At least that's what we're supposed to be doing. Shabbos is Kulei Lashem. It's supposed to be a holy day. We're not even supposed to be interacting with the world. It's prayer and it's family time and it's spiritual time. And so if you want to have that real Shabbos experience, why would you choose to eat meat or chicken, etc.? Where no matter how you twist it, even if it's kosher meat or chicken, there's the potential inherent in fish and chicken because you have to remove certain parts of the cow that aren't kosher. Even in poultry, you have to slaughter it a certain way. You have to get rid of the blood. Fish blood is kosher. There's no prohibition in the Torah. If you take a fish out of water, as long as the fish is kosher, there's nothing in that kosher fish that's prohibited. You can eat it from head to toe.
Doesn't have toes.
Thank you. Head to tail without any issues. You don't have to cook it. You don't have to salt it. You don't have to do anything. So Shabbos comes. You want to have a holy day. The first thing you want to do is eat something that has the least potential halachic Torah prohibitions associated with it, which is a fish. Go ahead.
That's the separation of the bones from the flesh, and that's why you have
to filter. Hold on. First, we're talking about why fish in general. Why we have a tendency to eat fish. Period. That came way before you filled the fish.
So should you be careful to taste the fish before you taste the dragon?
Not necessarily. The reason we eat the fish again is about pleasure. If you have more pleasure eating your fish with chreng, you zum to hate.
But which one you taste first?
What is
chreng? Chreng is the horseradish. You have to consult with a rabbi that's senior to me. These are complicated questions for me. So it comes Shabbos. A fish is something that is constantly in its source of life. It's always connected. A fish doesn't hang out outside of the water. It's always surrounded by its source of life. Until you kill it, it can't survive on its own outside of its source of life. Which is a reminder of how the Jew is supposed to be on Shabbos, submerged in its source of life. And so there's many connections for why we eat fish on Shabbos. But then came Mick's point, very nice, what does gefilte fish have to do with it? So you're going to find two reasons now. One of them is economical. If you remember, a lot of answers in Judaism are just simple math of how the finances work. And another one is associated with what you were talking about, Mick, but it's both included in text number 9, so Stana, go ahead and read for us text number 9.
In the last 200 years or so, the custom has become to eat Sabbath fish as gefilte fish. That phrase is, of course, the Yiddish for stuffed fish. In the original version of this delicacy, the fish was chopped, mixed with flour and condiments, and this filling was used to stuff the skin of the fish. The whole was then cooked, cut into slices, and served. An important reason why fish rather than meat became the preferred Sabbath fish dish was economics. Impoverished Jewish communities could hardly have afforded meat on every ordinary Sabbath, but some kind of fish was usually available at prices that were within reach. The utilization of every morsel was important for a poor community in the making of gefilte fish. The housewife could use every ounce.
So, starter, the first answer is that you take a fish, you can grind it up, and if you grind it up, you can use the bones, you can use some of the skin, you can use all chazarai that's part of the fish, and that's what Jewish mothers would do, and the housewives would do, and so they'd save a lot of money. Instead of just cutting nice fillets, which ends up costing a lot of money, especially if you're feeding a large family, you grind it up and you get yourself a lot more in the process, and you can mix it in with other stuff that are much cheaper, which, trust me, that's what they do. And so that was the first reason. It was just economical. But then there's the halachic bonus, if you wish, of it. Continue, Stana.
The Sabbath law specified the preferred manner in which the edible part of the food shall be separated from the inedible portion, or even the manner in which the residue of the meal, such as the peelings and bits of fruit or the bones and skin of fish, can be removed from the table is laid down in rules, in bell rules. To do so according to the strictures of halacha requires learning, which not everyone possessed and which could not be expected from the indigent guests who were often invited to the Sabbath table. All of these problems were eliminated by serving the fish in boneless and skinless portions. Come, let us give credit to Israel, the holy people, writes Halakhic authority in the name of Brisker Rav for establishing the custom of eating fish on the Sabbath in the form of stuffed fish, thereby eliminating all manner of religious scruples and doubts.
There's another good reason.
Yeah.
Shabbos on fish. Have Shabbos.
Have fish on Shabbos, yeah?
Yeah, you can have dairy desserts.
Okay. I don't think in the shtetl when they came up with the gavilavish that was their concern. I think they were trying to survive. I don't know that desserts was on the menu. If you read what she said, if you saw what she read about the fact that they couldn't even afford meat and chicken, which is why fish became a primary part of it. You know the story I'll just mention briefly, the woman came crying into the synagogue, "Rabbi, Rabbi," it's a true story. I have a very challenging question I need the rabbi to answer. Are you allowed to fulfill the mitzvah of drinking the 4 cups of wine on milk? Rabbi said, yeah. And then as she left the room, he told one of his students, go make sure she gets a case of wine at her house. Her question wasn't based on if she wanted to drink milk. The reality was she couldn't afford the wine, and so she had the question. And so in reality, a lot of things in Judaism, we take that into consideration. And there may be benefits in halacha, but gefilte fish inherently, think about it. Besides the economical part, which today you can argue that it's not as... But even take around this Shabbos table. If I served salmon, for example, to every person around the Shabbos table, it cost me $150 a Shabbos. If I serve gefilte fish, it cost me $25 to $35 a Shabbos. Just take the basic economics. Now add to that the halachic issue. Most people around my table don't know the laws of Boyer. Most Orthodox Jews don't know the laws of Boyer of taking good from bad on Shabbos because it's complex. You know, I think from this and I think from that. So an average Jew who's coming to the Chabad even for many years doesn't know the laws. At least they don't know it well enough to actually follow it to the... So what's the better option? Give them gefilte fish and you solve the problem. Now, it brings us immediately into the concept of cholent. It's a nice idea to have cholent on Shabbos. You know, they say the story about a little boy and his family were having dinner at their bubby's house, at their grandma's house. When everyone was seated, the food was served. As soon as the little boy got his plate, he started eating from it. So his father said, Yossi, please wait until we say a prayer. I don't have to, said Yossi. Of course you have to, said his father. Don't we always say a prayer before eating at our house? To which the boy said, yes, that's in our house, but this is Bubby's house and she knows how to cook. And, you know, when you talk about cholent, someone could say, well, what is cholent? Cholent is, you know, Jewish mother didn't know what to do, so she threw everything left in the kitchen into a pot and she created a stew. But the truth is, if you look, for Ashkenazic Jews, we call it cholent, and it's a mixture of, you know, potatoes, meat, sometimes rice, onions, then you have for Sephardim, it's called chamin, which is way more spicy. Sometimes it has chickpeas and dumplings and other stuff. But actually, if you go to the historical part of it, till today in Israel, you have what's called dafina or skina, which in Spain and Maghreb and Morocco, the Jews there had a different kind of hot dish, which had eggs in it as well. They would put eggs in and let it cook as hard-boiled eggs in the cholent. You have osh savo, which is a sweet and sour type of dish that the Bukharian Jews would eat. You have something called tabit, or pecha, or pecha, which is what the Iraqi Jews used to eat. There's all these different hot dishes, warm dishes that are cooking from before Shabbos that various communities, one thing you got to say, Ashkenazic, Sephardic, Yemenite, Iraqi, Bukhari, all Jews are eating something very hot on Shabbos. Why? What's it all about? Not only that, it's interesting that Harry Hine, who was a Jewish man who was born in Dusseldorf, Germany in 1797, unfortunately, he didn't receive much of a Jewish education. In 1825, he converted to become a Protestant. And he changed his name to Heinrich. Instead of Hein, it became Heinrich. And at that time, the Prussian government had been passing some discriminatory laws against the Jews, and he wanted to go to university. Bottom line is, he was an apostate Jew, converted to become a Protestant. And as he wrote himself, it was his ticket to admission into European culture. 25 years after he converted, quote unquote, we just said last week you can't convert out of Judaism, but in practice he had converted out of Judaism. 25 years later he reminisced about the Shabbos experience in the Jewish home. What did he write in his essay about Shabbos? He wrote an entire paragraph about cholent. What did he write about Shalom? Very poetic. Mick, you read last, or it's up to you? Text number 10 from Heinrich Heine.
She denies her lover nothing, save the smoking of tobacco. Dear, smoking is forbidden, for today is the Sabbath. But at noon, as compensation, there shall steam for thee a dish, that in very truth divine is, thou shalt eat it today of shalat.
Which is the Yiddish, the German term. Shalat was the term they used for cholent. It was the same thing. Go on.
Shalat, bread of Latin marl. Shalat, daughter of Elysium. So has she.
Which is like a paradise-like state, Elysium.
So had Schiller's song resounded, he had ever tasted shalat. For this shalat is the very food of heaven, which on Sinai God himself instructed Moses in the secret of preparing.
This is from a guy who's 25. Shalat, it reminds me of when I first met a certain Jew here in town at Cafe M. He saw me for the first time and I handed him a little package of Hamantashen for Shalach Manas for Purim, and he looked at it. I'll never forget it in my life. At least I hope I won't. He looked at it and goes, "Humintashen? It's been like 30 years." But the word Humintashen came out of his mouth as if it was yesterday afternoon that he heard the word. There were Jews that, with all their traveling away from their tradition, the foods that they ate at home was something that stuck with them. And so, but that doesn't answer why we eat chalent. That just answers that chalent's been around for a while, but why? Let's look at text number 11. Quincy, go ahead.
You shall not cause to burn. You shall not cause fire to burn any of your dwelling places on the day of Shabbat.
So there's a prohibition in the book of Exodus that you're not allowed to light a fire on Shabbos. There were two ways to interpret the verse. There were the Karaites, the Reformed Jews of old. Except they were reformed in a religious way. They did follow the biblical law, but in a warped, weird interpretation. They said you're not allowed to light a fire, which means you're not allowed to experience any type of flame on Shabbos, even if the flame was lit before Shabbos, so they would have no electricity in the house, or no candles lit before Shabbos. They would eat Shabbos in the dark, and even Shabbos day, they wouldn't eat anything hot, because you're not allowed to eat anything hot on Shabbos. They would specifically eat only cold. Then there was the traditional understanding, the way it was interpreted by Moses when they gave the Torah, the original, the oral tradition, where Moses said, no, what it means is very simple, you're not allowed to light a flame on Shabbos, but if it's lit before and it's done in the proper way, it's no issue. To make a statement that we have nothing to do with the Karaites and their weird interpretation of the biblical law, we deliberately make sure to eat a hot dish on Shabbos day, to make a statement that we have nothing to do with those people that have a negative and a wrong interpretation of the Torah. And that is why, in all communities, Sephardic, Ashkenazic, wherever you go, they had some tradition of having a hot dish. The content of it, honestly, there's no halachic requirement. You can make a hot dish of whatever you'd like to cook in a crock pot before Shabbos. If you want it to be a fish dish, by all means. I don't think fish for 24 hours in a pot is going to do very well. I'm not an expert.
Fish too is good.
Okay, because it can go 20. It can go 18, 24 hours?
Yeah, just had some.
Huh?
Just had some. It's been cooking all week.
Okay, there you go. Cooking all week, okay. I'm not going to ask you how that works, but I trust you, Quincy. Bottom line is, but they always had a tradition of eating something hot because that was the statement. The statement was we had nothing to do with the Karaites. Later it was a group called the Sadducees, and the groups kept on popping up and shutting down. But the bottom line is, we are not followers of the written law. We are followers of the wholesome Torah. And the wholesome Torah includes both what the actual words at Sinai, as well as the interpretations that were given orally, directly from God to Moses at Sinai, and given by Moses to the Jewish people, which is why it is important that if you don't have the custom, and even if you're not in the mood of chalent, and you don't need it, it's going to make you feel blah, 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 take a little bit of chalent, and symbolically eat a something hot on Shabbos day, to symbolize that you're not part of the loony bins, not the loony bins associated with the lunar, that we spoke about earlier, but the real loony bins, who have a weird interpretation of the Torah. Go ahead.
So, what about for ages and ages, everyone that lived in the northern hemisphere heated with wood. They burned wood to stay warm. just like I do now. It's the only source of food I have in my home.
Yeah.
So is there a problem putting wood on an existing fire?
Absolutely.
Why?
You're lighting a fire.
No, the fire is already...
That piece of wood is now on fire because you stuck it into the fire.
The same is true for your natural gas that comes into your house.
What natural gas? I never touched any natural gas.
You have pipes that have natural gas.
If you had a system where every hour a piece of wood would fly off a mechanism and land in the fire, there's maybe room for discussion about it.
Well, that's what pellet stoves are.
Who?
Pellet stove. So if you filled up the hopper before...
Probably fine.
It'd be fine.
If it feeds on its own, I don't see why... I don't know for sure because I never studied this.
But I'm for sure, people that were living in places where it was 50 degrees below zero...
That is weird. By the way, the concept of a Shabbos goy...
But if they couldn't afford a Shabbos goy?
Shabbos goy normally didn't cost any money. You had neighbors that were not Jewish that did this for... They did this... I don't know if you know, I just read that, what was his name, the Supreme Court, the first black Supreme Court justice.
Thurgood.
What was his first
Thurgood
name?
Marshall.
Thurgood Marshall. He was a Shabbos goy in Baltimore, which is why when he joined the Supreme Court, he knew all the laws about the Jewish lawyers who can't come on Shabbos. He said he used to do for 25 cents a Jewish home. He knew every Jewish holiday from A to Z because he'd make a killing off of it. To answer your question, Jews did live most, at least a big part of our history in Eastern Europe, which was a very cold place.
And it'd
be a lot colder. Yeah, no, there's no question. And first of all, they'd light a gazette to fire before Shabbos, a pretty solid fire that can last as long as possible. But they had mechanisms set up with whether it was the parrots or the there's no real English word for parrots, but the powers that be would have a system in the town to make sure that people had wood put into their fires if they needed it on Shabbos. It's a question, by the way, just for the record, I want to clarify that you asked me at least 4 or 5 times in the last 9 years about the stoves on Shabbos. I just want to point that out. I think Mick's point, about, which is something I never heard of, which is, what do you call it, a pellet feeding? There are ways to do it. I mean, I don't... no one's recommending you sit in -50 without wood, without a fire. I mean, you said it's the only form of fire, that's the only form of heating, you mean. When Ray makes a scrambled egg, I assume she doesn't do it on the fire, she has a stove top, I assume.
Yeah, we have a gas ring.
Oh, okay, you do have stuff, I'm just saying.
It's not Shabbos, but the wood stove...
Keeps you warm, I understand. First of all, it's not...
And I know that had to be the way it was for Jews... Back in
of course it was. Well, what else? They didn't have electric.
No, they didn't.
So of course it was. But there was mechanisms. By the way, the only time halacha says you're allowed to use a Shabbos goy, by the way, it's another misconception. You're not allowed to use a Shabbos goy for every random thing. It's a big mistake. A lot of Orthodox Jews. Turn on television. I'm talking about even my Zayda used to go and he'd go. Listen, we need the heat on, the light off. We don't use a non-Jew because it takes away from your Shabbos experience. The only time halacha actually mentions that you're allowed to use a Shabbos goy is when it's freezing cold and it could be deathly and you bring in a goy to turn on the heat. The rabbis have said that in a place like Florida, for example, in August, the same rule would apply if for whatever reason the air went out because you can die of overheating. But that's really the only two scenarios. And so that is the exact scenario that halacha refers to. And my guess is that if 250 years ago and 500 years ago in the codes of Jewish law, they were referring to the issue of having a non-Jew come in and help you heat for warmth, that's exactly the mechanism that they used.
I guess the confusion for me stems around the translation of the word kindle. Because kindle has a definite meaning in English. And it means
starting a fire.
Starting a fire.
And in halacha,
feeding fire.
Well, but again, that's an English that's a semantics thing because when you, like I said, when you take that dry piece of wood and you throw it into the fire, at that moment you are igniting that wood. You're making that wood go aflame. So we can fight about, we can argue about the semantics. I don't think we're going to get to the conclusion of it tonight, but. But my guess is that that's an English issue with words, not with the Torah's translation of kindling. Kindling is you just kindled that piece of wood. But why is that different than the first time you kindled?
So what's the Hebrew of the commandment not to kindle a fire?
Loisavaru.
And what does that mean?
Not to create a flame, not to ignite, not to...
So the difference between... You're saying a single fire is a single fire.
By the way, look at the translation. But look at the translation. Doesn't it say kindle? You shall not cause fire to burn in any of your dwelling places on the day of Shabbos.
Where is this translation of kindle?
Probably the King James version. No, I'm not joking. A lot of the translations we have are unfortunately were not originated. I'm curious, just for the heck of it, I'm going to take a peek in one of the other flourishes to see how they translate it. What does it say? Exodus what?
This is Exodus 35:3.
Exodus 35:3, it was just recently. It says here, see here it says you should not kindle fire in any of your dwelling places on the Shabbos day. So that would feed right into your understanding of kindling. But bottom line is that there's no question that historically, from the interpretation of the Torah from day one, it was very clear that there was no lighting fire, which is why we use, but to light it before Shabbos and use it on Shabbos is all part of where the concept of cholent comes from. We're going to skip the next question because it's just, I'm looking at the clock, we're not going to get them all in. 217, let's go look at this question. Why does Jewish law recognize matrilineal descent as the deciding factor of Jewish identity? And so, this question obviously is not academic. It's a deeply personal question for many, many people. In an age where intermarriage has become so common, and where there's so many issues of non-halachic gear, there's non-halachic conversions. It could be very hurtful to people. They feel very offended if they consider themselves a Jew because their dad was Jewish or whatever. And now they're told suddenly that, you know, halacha doesn't consider them Jewish, even though they may have Jewish blood. And the truth is, most of the time they're not looking for an answer, but they're simply looking for a way to change the law. Most people don't want an answer. They don't want an explanation as to why they aren't Jewish. They want someone to tell them that we can change the law and say that you are Jewish. What's interesting about the question is that one would have expected things to be the other way. In other words, if you look at the ancient world, the parent who mattered was the father. A Greek philosopher, I have a hard time pronouncing his name, I think it's Aeschylus.
Aeschylus
maybe, yeah. So Aeschylus said, and I quote, "The woman you call the mother of the child is not the parent. She is merely the nurse of the seed that was sown inside her." So the ancient way of thinking was that the father is the most important thing. The mother is...
That's why Abraham had, handmaiden for half of his family.
For extracurricular activities? Or...
No, I mean, because Sarah was barren, and so she said, take Hagar, and it was the same thing. It was exactly...
The father mattered, not the mother.
Exactly.
So, then...
Is that way with the tribes? Is that way with inheritance?
There's a lot of things that go by the father, except not the Judaism doesn't go by the father. And people say, oh, that's just another example of misogyny in Judaism, blah, blah, blah. Now, the question is valid for one simple reason. Race is a matter of descent. A person's race. Religion and faith, presumably, should not be. It should be based on the way you were raised. It's faith and religion and however you are. So if you happen to be a son or a daughter of a Jewish father, and you were raised as a Jew, why should the fact that your mother isn't Jewish matter to how you experience your faith and religion if you were raised as a Jew? Take a look at text number 16 for the book of Deuteronomy. I think we're up to you, Pam. Go ahead.
Not only with you am I making this covenant and this oath. I'm making this covenant with those standing here with us today before God and with those who are not here with us today.
Judaism is an oath from God with a set of responsibilities and a mission associated with being Jewish. We spoke about last week, Jews have a mission, non-Jews have a mission, and if you're a Jew, it comes with a set of responsibilities to fulfill your mission in this world. To be part of that mission, that is endowed to a child through the mother. Why through the mother, we'll see in a minute. But the first thing you need to know is that it's not about an association. We're not looking to see members in a club or something. Because if it was just members in a club, yeah, your father was part of the club, why don't you be part of the club too? It's about a mission. And to be part of this group of people that are endowed with that mission, it comes from the mother. You know, they say the story about a young teacher explains to her class that she's an atheist. So she asks her class if they are atheists too. Not really knowing what atheism was, but wanting to be like their teacher, the hands go up in the ear, And everyone is saying that they're an atheist. Except there's one little child in the back named Sarah. Her hand doesn't go up with the crowd. The teacher asks her why she decided to be different. She said, because I'm not an atheist. So the teacher says, then what are you? She says, I'm Jewish. The teacher's upset. Her face is slightly red, and she asks Sarah why she's Jewish. She says, well, I was brought up knowing and loving God. My mom is Jewish and my dad is Jewish, so I'm Jewish. The teacher's so angry, she says, that's no reason. What if your mom was a Mormon and your dad was a Mormon? What would you be then? To which the child smiled and answered, I'd be an atheist. And, you know, when you talk about all these things, my mother was a Jew, so I'm a Jew. What does that actually mean? Why would that be based on my mother? What if my father sat and schlepped me to Hebrew school every week? And now I'm 18 years old. I spent my whole life going to shul. By the way, there's been times where they found people in yeshivas who they had no idea that they had no idea that their mother wasn't halachically Jewish. And they're 22 years old now in a yeshiva. They had one in Mir Yeshiva and some of the greatest yeshivas in the world. Found out they weren't Jewish and they had to go through a conversion. Why? If someone's so immersed in Judaism, why the mother? Let's look at text number 17.
I have to quote Katrina. This whole conversation. I have a Jewish mother, Katrina Corbin, who used to live with me. When I showed up, and she was our Suju. She was half Sioux and half Jewish. And she used to say to everybody this. She said, "Mother, baby, father."
By the way, we're going to get to that. By the way, it's a very good line. We're going to get to that. It's the last piece of this whole puzzle. But, Stana, go ahead with text number 17.
According to the Torah law, a child's Jewishness depends on his or her mother. We do not know the reason for the Torah's laws. Some offer biological-based rationale that the mother is more involved in the creation of a child and the formation of its body and soul. Some offer a nurture-based rationale that a mother's consistent influence is more decisive in shaping her children. Others suggest that a practical rationale that we know indisputably the identity of one's mother.
Quincy, your point, or her point.
Ultimately, what matters is not the rationale for this law, but the foundational law itself, in which is the bedrock of the Jewish family has shaped the Jewish people.
You got to start from the beginning. In other words, let's start with his first point. That is because the mother is the one that forms the child for the most part. When the Torah in Genesis talks about Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, the first human beings, Adam is named Adam because he came from Adamah, he came from the earth. When Eve is named Chava, why is she called Chava? Look at text number 18, Mick, go ahead. This is a biblical verse in Genesis.
Adam called his wife Chava, because she was the mother of all life.
She was called Isha, she was called a woman, and she had another name immediately, which is the name that she was known for, which is Chava. In her name, the definition of her name was not just about her creation, right? She wasn't named coming from the rib or whatever. She was named Chava, the mother of all life. A woman, by definition, is defined very much, not only... Don't let the feminists start screaming yet. It's not only by motherhood, but a big part of how a woman is defined is by the gift of motherhood. Let's just start from there. Adam, there was nothing in Adam's name, Adam, that has anything to do with fatherhood. Chava is immediately associated with motherhood. Then there's the educational part of it, the way the mother raises the child. Text number 19 from Rabbi J.B. Soloveitchik, the founder of OU. Go ahead, Quincy, 19.
What kind of Torah does the mother define? I admit that I am not able to define precisely the Masoretic traditional role of the Jewish mother. Only by circumscription, I hope to be able to explain it. But it's often not like circumcision. Permit me to draw upon my own experiences. I used to have long conversations with my mother. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite prayers. I used to watch her recite the Siddurah every Friday night, and I still remember the nostalgic tune. I learned from her very much. Most of all, I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in a formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, and a warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The laws of Shabbat, for instance, were passed on to me by my father. The Shabbat remains a living entity, as a queen was revealed to me by my mother. The fathers knew much about the Shabbat. The mothers lived the Shabbat, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor.
This is not an answer. In other words, if you're going to have a militant feminist, or in this case, a militant, I don't know what's the opposite of a masculinist. What is the opposite of a feminist?
But
patriarch. If you can have a militant patriarch defending the fatherly role, you could read Rabbi Soloveitchik's words and throw it out the window. Because they're coming with militant, and with militant, to be honest, you're not going to get anywhere with anything. But if you want to have a rational conversation, you could talk about the fact that a mother, by definition, is more associated with the formation of a child. You could talk about the fact that the raising of a child, which is so important and vital to the Jewish child, and don't start bringing me proof. Well, I know a Jewish mother who never did that. But that's not relevant, so she wasn't doing her job. There's always people not doing their job. It doesn't change the fact that that's what they should be doing. And then there's the third aspect, which, like Quincy said, mother, baby, dad, father, maybe. Which is, at the end of the day, you don't really know who the father is. Yeah, you could say, well, there's some, they look a little bit like, you know, it's all circumstantial. Reality is, when a mother gives birth, if it comes out of her womb, it's her baby. Although today, with the surrogacy and stuff, that's not either a guarantee. But, no, IVF you can still guarantee. Surrogacy is a whole different ballgame.
Oh, well, not if it's an IVF of someone else's egg,
I understand. But the bottom line is that when it comes out of her womb, you know that she carried that baby for X amount of time. And the father, we don't know a thing. We can only assume. We can trust people. There's a lot of trust involved. And so, yes, Judaism, a lot of things are associated with that. But the descent of the child, if that child is going to be Jewish or not, is dependent on whose womb it was in for 9 months. Or if they go through a conversion, which is another whole parasha. Go ahead.
So a surrogate mother?
That's not a question for tonight. A surrogate mother is one of the most hotly debated topics today. Not today, in the last 10 years in the world of halacha. There is no consensus at this point as to the result of who that child. But let's just say, when we studied our medical ethics course, we had part of that touched on. And it's not a concluded discussion. There's no conclusion yet in the realm of surrogacy. There are rabbis, there's one in Sydney, Australia. There's one in Buenos Aires, Argentina, that are experts in the realm of IVF and surrogacy. They studied it from a medical perspective, and they have opinions, but there's no consensus about it. It's like donor sperm. Donor sperm is prohibited by every sage that we know of. The only sage that ever permitted it was Moshe Feinstein, but every other sage was against him. So, there's no real consensus. Oh, with sperm donation, there is a consensus. With surrogacy and IVF, as of today, there is still no conclusive consensus of how we are, you know, what the Jewish approach is, because it's still, honestly, I mean, it's still developing in many realms of the surrogacy stuff. There's still a lot of things developing, and that also has to do with uterus transplant. Just last week, there was a woman in Cleveland that had a uterus transplant. It was on the news. I actually heard it, and I was laughing because we discussed it at a class years ago about uterus transplant. Why do some Jews at least wear old-fashioned clothing? Rabbi, why do you have to wear clothing from the 18th century that they used to wear in Europe? You wear a black hat and a black coat. And why do you have to wear these funny... I'm not talking about religious garb. I'm talking about style of clothing. Why do many traditional Jews, whether it's Yemenite Jews wearing Yemenite clothing or Jews from Europe wearing European clothing, what is that business all about? Let's start... Is a car pulling up? It's just my wife. The general idea about clothing, you need to remember that the Russian Tsar, Nicholas I, Yimach Shemoy, may his name be erased, enacted a series of initiatives during his reign, which was 1825 to 1855, intended to assimilate millions of Jewish people in his empire. One of the initiatives that was issued in 1844 was called the clothing decree. He said that all Jews have to stop wearing their traditional garb and they have to dress like the Russians dress, like they did in the Russian Empire, because we don't want them to stand out. The only ones that were permitted to wear unique clothing were the senior rabbis, which were very few and far beyond. There were not a lot of them. The average Jew was prohibited from wearing his Jewish garb. At that time, it consisted of a long black coat, which reached the ankles and was closed right over left, with a belt or buckle. They would have, like till today you see in many Hasidic dynasties, their socks, their pants would go up to the top of their socks, and on the weekday it was one day, and Shabbos was another. I'm sorry, in the summer it was a certain way, the winter, depending on the weather, because if it was muddy, they would have it higher up. If it was the summer, they would have it lower down. They had different garb that they wore. Came along the Tsar and said men and women should get rid of all their traditional clothing. Why was it so important for the majority of Jews in Eastern Europe to maintain their clothing? It's clothing, for heaven's sake. What do you care to just wear Russian clothing? And the question still remains till today. Do Jews need to dress differently? Why do Jews need to dress differently? I go to the governor's mansion, I have to wear a black hat. That has to be specifically, when I moved to Montana, there were people that said, Rabbi, you should buy a cowboy hat. No, I'm not buying a cowboy hat. I have my hat, I have my style. Why be different? Especially if it's not obligatory. It's not a mitzvah to wear a black hat. It's a tradition that comes from my group of people. There's other groups that have different traditions. You know, why? Why do you have to stand out? So there was the Rishur Rekeach, the first Belz of Rebbe, the Hasidic dynasty of Belz. And he says that if you look in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, when Yaakov fled, when Jacob fled from Israel to avoid his brother Esau, after many years they were finally going to reconcile. Years later, 25, 20 some years later, they were going to meet up again. And Esau, at the end of the encounter, Esau requests that they both travel together. Let's travel together to our destination. But Jacob refused. Why did he refuse? There's a lot of traditional commentary why he refused. But Rabbi Shur Rokeach, the Belzer Rebbe, said that it's very much connected to clothing. Look at text number 20, go ahead, pen.
Esau wanted Jacob to wear the same clothes as him. In all other matters, he agreed that Jacob could choose to be different. Jacob responded, pointing to the fact that the children are tender. Jacob was saying that although he would not be influenced by sharing Esau's way of dress, his children would be influenced, and it would lead to assimilation.
Right. He said, listen, if my kids, I don't mind, I change my, by the way, and I can say that about myself. If I wear a pink shirt instead of a white shirt, or a brown coat instead of a black coat, I don't think it's going to change who I am. I don't know. Perhaps I'm also weak like the children. I don't think it's going to change my identity. But if my children don't stand out in their dress code, if when they get to a certain age they don't look different, what are the chances of them even recognizing that they're different after a certain while and not realizing that they are different than the people around them? Clothing has very much to do with your identity. Let's not fool ourselves. I just told someone this week, we were talking about yarmulkes, and I mentioned that another member of our community started wearing a yarmulke wherever he goes, and how the great effect that it's had on the people around and how he feels the result of it. And I was telling this individual, I think it was yesterday here at the shul, when I was studying with him, try it! He was saying that he goes into different places of business, and they sometimes think he's too much of an East Coaster. I said, how about walking with a yarmulke and see how they respond? You may find out that they suddenly have a different respect for you. And I use the other individual as an example. So what the Belzer Rebbe was saying is that Yaakov recognized that for children and for adults likewise, it's important to stand out with your dress code because it keeps you separate. It shows that you are different, that you don't end up assimilating. It's very hard to assimilate when you don't fit clothing-wise. One of the first things that people do when they leave the path of orthodoxy for whatever reason, they want to fit in. And how do you fit in? You get rid of the garb. Who wants to hang out in a bar with a guy that's wearing a shtreimel and long payas and a black coat with socks in that are white with shoes that look like from the 40s and glasses from the 30s? No one! They think you're crazy, they want to give you a pill or something to go see a doctor. What? You start looking modern and wow, oh yeah, I'd love to hang with you. So clothing is very much about our identity, and it's been proven, if it helps people academically, it's been proven as well in the schools of academia. This is just one example, text 21. I think we're up to you, Stana. Right? Yeah, go ahead.
A study this year from Northwestern University examined a concept called enclosed cognition. Researchers define in their report as the systematic influence that clothes have on the wearer's psychological processes, meaning that when what your clothes are saying to you, not about you. That the clothes have on the wearer's psychological processes, meaning what your clothes are saying to you, not about you, and how they make you feel. The researchers distributed standard white lab coats to participants, telling some that it was a doctor's coat and some that it was a painter's smock. All participants performed the same task, but those wearing the doctor's coat were more careful and attentive. Their actions were influenced by their clothing. Enclosed cognition gives scientific proof to the idea that you should dress not how you feel, but how you want to feel. The clothes you choose are sending a message to those around you, but also to you yourself.
You should read this paragraph to this person who you were talking to about the kippah.
Yeah. Changes the way you behave too.
Well, you know,
you know that, Quincy, for years.
Oh, yeah. But, you are the most radical Havadnik dresser that I know. And yet, you know, it's hardly like you're not conservative. It's just that you wear a blue shirt, you wear a red yarmulke. You know?
I'm working on the shorts.
Yeah, we'll get there. But the best explanation of this that we're talking about, I heard, was from an old man in Israel.
In Israel?
Yeah. And he said, we were discussing some point about not wearing clothing that was torn. I don't remember where it was from, where the passage came from. And I don't like to wear anything that's ragged. If it's got a little hole in it, you patch it or whatever. But he said that there is a principle behind that, which is, he said, you should be prepared to meet your maker constantly. So he said, you should dress as if you were planning on meeting a king today, like now, this minute, because that's a very real possibility.
Well, certainly that way for Shabbos, when you think about the Shabbos clothes and you're hanging with Hashem.
Yeah, but think about Shabbos clothes. It's so much easier just to, you know, straighten up and wash up a little and come to shul or come to Shabbos morning. Or you have a set, you go literally to a store, like I did as a child, and we bought clothing until today. Chavi buys for the kids and for myself. For Shabbos, we call it Shabbos clothes.
I have clothes on anymore.
It's a suit, or it's a nice pair of slacks, and it's set aside. You don't use it during the week. It's not your weekday clothes. It's your Shabbos clothing. It's unique for Shabbos, so you can experience and honor Shabbos the way, like Quincy mentioned, or like Mick mentioned, the way you would honor a king. Or you know, and this is Shabbos, is called the Shabbos Queen, whatever you want to refer to it, but kingship or royalty. It should be royal. We go to weddings, we're busy with tuxedos, and we're going to be the woman, what are they called? The flower girl and this boy and what do they call the boys? The
ring bearer.
No, that's a funeral, no? The pallbearers. What's the other one? You know, when the men have a bunch of guys with them,
groomsmen
or the bridesmaids, they're busy for weeks, they're going to Shabbos! It's not a one-time wedding, it's a weekly event that you have a union with your Creator. You can't buy a parhoizen, a pair of pants, and a shirt that's special for Shabbos? But we only have 10 minutes left, and I want to get in the next question, because Quincy's been babbling about it for 9 years, at least that I know, probably for 35 years, but I wasn't around to hear it for all the years. He always has his joke that Quincy shares, that Moses went up to Sinai, and the Almighty's conveying the text of the Torah to him. God tells Moses, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. And Moses looks up at God and says, by this I assume you mean that you should not eat meat and milk at the same time. No, replies the Almighty, I simply said do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. Okay, says Moses, do you mean that I should have separate dishes for meat and milk? No, said the Master of the Universe, I simply said do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. Fine, said Moses, so you mean that we should wait 6 hours after meat before we eat milk? All right, Moses, the Holy One says, have it your way. And God just surrendered and said, that's how it is. But All jokes aside, we have to understand something. The Torah says, literally, there's three times in the Torah it says, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. So simply, you'd say, A, it has to be a young goat, a kid. B, it has to be cooked together. And C, it has to be its mother's milk, not other milk. Comes along the Rambam, Maimonides, and tells us that from the oral tradition, from the way Moses interpreted it at Sinai, three things. Number one, it's all meat, not only a young kid. Number two, it's cooked or eaten together, not just cooked. And C, with any milk, not just, I should say animal milk, not almond milk, but any animal milk, not just its mother's milk. And look at text 23. Go ahead, Michal.
The Torah says, you shall not cook a kid in its mother's milk. The received tradition teaches us that this verse forbids both the cooking and eating of milk with meat.
So the question really is, and that's really the question that Quincy wants to ask. Quincy's not asking why we do it. Quincy's asking why the Torah couldn't be a little clearer. What would be a clearer way to say it? Don't cook and eat milk and meat together. Why does it say cook? And then we have to assume that cook means also eating, blah, blah, blah. Just say it clear. Why do you have to leave the naysayers? And trust me, Quincy's not the naysayer, but there's plenty of them I've encountered who are not looking, they're not really naysayers. They're looking for a kappa, they're looking for a way out. It's not like if I showed them a verse that says it, they would change their mind anyhow. They just happen to have a verse, you know, oh look, this is a misinterpretation. So there's Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, a fairly recent rabbi sage, and he addressed the question in his biblical commentary. He says, first of all, you can the oral tradition that we have now, from, that we learn from Maimonides, you know, that it's not just the young kid, and it's not just cooking, it's also eating, and it's not just its mother's milk, you can actually learn it from the actual verse. In other words, if you actually study the verse, instead of reading it in a simple translation, if you actually study the linguistic, the language that the Torah is using for the prohibition, you will see the exact prohibition. How? He says, look at the first word. It says, loy sevashel, which means you shall simply, you shall not cook. But the truth is, in Hebrew, the word bishul, which is cooking, can mean three things. In Hebrew language, the word bishul means three things. It means cooking, it means roasting, and it means ripening. Like when it's bikurei chitim or bikurei anavim, the ripening of grapes, the ripening of fruit. The Hebrew word is bishul. That it's the word for ripening can also be bishul. So all three of them, what do they actually mean? To prepare something. Cooking, roasting, ripening, that's all prep. And so if something is prohibited from being prepped, you can ascertain that it's prohibited from being consumed. If even the prep of it is prohibited, certainly the eating of it is prohibited. So if you translate it as cook, and you say, well, yeah, why does it have to say cook? But it doesn't. It says leisavasha, which means the prep of it, the ripening of it, the roasting of it, the cooking of it, it's all in the prep realm. So if you're not allowed to prepare something, certainly you're not allowed to eat it. That's his first understanding. The second one is it says gdi. What do we translate it? A kid. He says if it wanted to say a kid, the Torah in other places, like in the book of Genesis, when it talks about a young goat, it says gdi izim, which is a kid from the goat family. A young goat. It's gdi izim. It's two words. Why over here, when it comes to cooking a kid in its mother's milk, does it say one word? Which actually doesn't refer specifically to a young goat, to a kid, but refers to all fellow. It would be redundant if it said if gdi meant a kid, then why would it have to say gdiism, which means the same thing? It would be redundant. So the fact that it says gdi, it includes multiple species, and then the word gdiism in Genesis makes sense. And when it says gdi, yeah, it's much easier to translate it as kid, but it's not the actual translation. It's a general term used for all types of domesticated animals. What about b'chalei imo, its mother's milk? You know when the Torah says your brother? Right? The terms when the Torah says you shall, you know, how do you treat your brother? And this is how you have to. There's a couple times the Torah refers to a brother. It doesn't mean your literal brother, it means a fellow Jew. That's how we understand all those times when it says your brother. So when it says mother here, it doesn't necessarily mean a mother, it means to any animal to all who give milk. So it's any type of milk, not just mother's milk, not the particular mother. So he takes the basic verse, and he says, you simply put, if you want to read an English translation and have questions, fine. But if you actually learn the exact words, the linguistics that are used in these words, you'll see that it actually means exactly the way Maimonides interpreted it in the oral law. I want you to take a look. This is fascinating. Look at the chart on page 225. The following chart contains a list of Talmudic laws pertaining to the prohibited mixture of meat and milk, determined from which word of the verse, you shall not cook a kid in its mother's milk, we can derive each law. You're not going to have time, really, to do it all. All these laws, every one of them that you're reading in the chart, is derived from the verse that says, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. From various derivations.
Okay, so I'm very curious about the fowl.
Yeah. It says gdi, it says a kid, a domesticated animal, and that limits a fowl. That's why, halakhically, a chicken is not, biblically, a chicken and milk is not a biblical prohibition. We know that, we've said it many times, that it's a rabbinic prohibition. It's not any less prohibited, but it's not a biblical one. For a Jew, it doesn't matter if it's rabbinic or biblical, we don't break the law. But it's an origin, it's not biblical.
This is the most confusing thing I've seen here.
Why?
Everything. But especially the prohibition does not apply to wild kosher species.
Yeah.
Like deer.
Huh?
So what? You can eat. You could boil a fawn in goat's milk or whatever. No. Surely.
Fawn?
A fawn's a baby deer.
It's not domesticated.
So, if you have a wild...
Yeah, the biblical prohibition against cooking milk and meat does not apply to a chaya. In halacha, there's a term of behemoth, which is a domesticated animal, and there's chaya, which is a wild beast, if you wish, and the law does not apply to a wild, biblically, it does not apply to a wild beast.
So you could get a wild animal that's not domesticated and shechet...
No. Wild animal is not defined by whether you domesticate it or not, or if it's running around. There's certain animals that are defined definitively as a chaya or a behemoth. In the next 1 minute, we're not going to be able to go through the whole list of which is which, but there are lists where you can read what is defined as domesticated, part of the domesticated family, and what's considered part of... But it doesn't mean it's prohibited, it doesn't mean it's permitted, it just means that biblically it wouldn't be prohibited. It doesn't mean that you can go ahead and eat it. There's rabbinic and there's biblical. The point of this chart is that if you understood if the Torah would have said, do not cook or eat a kid in its mother's milk, you'd learn none of these words. So the fact that the Torah uses specific words gives us an opportunity, like everything else in the Torah, when the specific words are used to teach us specific laws. Take a look at example text number 24. Go ahead, Quincy.
Well, this is crazy. You know goats don't like to.
Go ahead.
You may ask, why did the Torah not write clearly, don't cook meat and milk? Know that there are many conditions that must be met before the combination of meat and milk amounts to
a biblical
prohibition. Among them, the meat and milk must be of a kosher domesticated species. To include all of this in a succinct written statement is virtually impossible. The Torah therefore chose a brief statement that would include all of the details.
So, we many times the Torah uses specific words, so we have the opportunity in the many tractates of the Talmud to learn details that we wouldn't be able to learn otherwise. So Quincy could sit here and debate about whether male goats lactate or not, or whether chicken, I think Quincy once argued that he saw a chicken eating a bug, or another animal, right? You saw them?
Chickens are very...
There you go. I remember what you told me. You might not remember what you told me, but I remember what you told me. The bottom line is, it's thank God I remember. Otherwise, you know, I think you every day these genius questions. At least now I know. Well, you asked me that 3 months ago, 6 months ago, 8 months ago. But the bottom line is that Yeah, I mean, I could sit back, take an English chumash, and sit on a couch and turn myself into this great theologian. Ah, the Torah says do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. I'm such a genius. All these rabbis made up all these laws. They simply don't understand the verse. No, you don't understand the verse because you're reading it in English without having the context of what the actual Hebrew words the Torah uses for it that teach us the various things it teaches us. Of course, I could take a simplistic, I could translate it to Russian, and then you'll tell me, oh, well, then it really doesn't mean this because in English it's Kindle. Is it really Kindle? Is it really igniting? We can play words with English. Torah is not in English. And the fact that it's been mistranslated is no one's fault but our own. But that's not an excuse. Just because someone gives us a mistranslation, they do it with the Constitution all day. I can take the Constitution and make it sound like the most socialist document that the world ever created. Not only could I, there are people doing this as we speak. It doesn't mean that the Constitution was socialist. It just means that people are misinterpreting it, and people do that with the Torah all day. But I don't want to leave you without the last question. I'll just wrap it up for you. The question was, why are eggs parv? If a chicken dies of natural causes, we're not allowed to eat the eggs from it because the chicken wasn't slaughtered. So obviously it's connected to the chicken. Yet, if the chicken's alive and an egg, it hatches an egg, it's parv. You can eat it with either milk or meat. Why is it so? The answer is actually very, very simple. We just said that biblically there's no prohibition against mixing poultry and milk. It's a rabbinic prohibition. In other words, inherently a chicken is not considered meat, it's not considered flesh, it's considered parv. It's only that the sages, because of how close poultry and meat have been intertwined with each other, they said we should prohibit poultry from milk as well. If that's the case, there's a rule in Judaism, you don't make a decree on another decree. And so chicken being flesh, being considered meat product, is a decree in itself of the rabbis. You don't make another decree on the decree to say that even the eggs that come from the chicken are also meat. The chicken in itself really shouldn't be meat. And so you certainly don't make the egg to be considered meat, which is why the egg inherently is parv, is not meat, which is why you can use eggs in meat, you can eat eggs in dairy, you can eat eggs, I was going to say in vegan, but you can't. You can eat, basically you can eat eggs in everything but in the poor vegans. And that wraps up today's class. Next week we will wrap up this course, and next week's class, that the questions we will address is, why have the Jews been singled out for persecution and hate throughout history? Why does Jewish childhood adulthood begin at age 12 for girls and 13 for boys? Why do we pour a cup of wine for Elijah at the Passover Seder? Why is it not forbidden to submit petitions of prayer to a righteous person? It's like idolatry. Why would you allow to go to a great rabbi for prayer? Isn't it true that Judaism forbids using intermediaries to access God? Why do Hasidim think it's necessary to have a Rebbe? Isn't it true that Jews do not require intermediaries to access God? Why is Moses' name absent from the Haggadah on Passover? And why does Judaism associate so many of its celebrations with food? Those questions will be answered next Thursday night. We look forward to seeing you there. Have a rocket.